This program is sponsored by Citadel Securities.
The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to Pritzker Military Presents, featuring a discussion by Sir Hugh Strawn entitled The First Last Stand, The Spring Offensives of 1918. I'm your host, Dr. Rob Havers, and this program is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago and is sponsored by Citadel Securities. This program and hundreds more are available on demand at PritzkerMilitary.org. From the 2019 On War Symposium, this program focused on the 75th anniversary of the Battle of the Bulge. The following presentation centers on the parallels between the Battle of the Bulge and the last German offensive in World War I. The spring offensives of 1918 were Germany's last attempt to defeat the Allied armies on the Western Front, where a decisive victory could turn the war in their favor before the American forces could be fully deployed. The goal of the four German offensives was to break through the Allied lines in the Somme region, outflank and divert the British, and defeat them. Yet logistical errors, failures to seize the initiative, as well as the increasing depletion of German resources failed to turn the tide for the Germans. Their failure by mid-summer left the German army fatally weakened, demoralized, and facing its own imminent and inevitable defeat as the 1 million US soldiers began to arrive in France by July. Award-winning author, historian, and military strategist Hugh Strawn was the recipient of the 2016 Pritzker Military Museum and Library Literature Award for Lifetime Achievement in Military Writing. Author of 14 major publications, including the first installment of his groundbreaking three-volume work on the Great War, the First World War to Arms, Strawn is known for his incredibly detailed and carefully researched writings. Please enjoy this episode of Pritzker Military Presents with Sir Hugh Strawn. Hugh, it is a great pleasure to have you here today. A little bit of a background to this key moment, this key potential turning point in World War I in 1918. What are the Germans trying to do, and what is their big gamble, essentially?
Well, they have a window of opportunity. They think, as indeed the Allies think, that the war will be won in 1919 or possibly early 1920 if it isn't lost by the Allies before then, because the United States' entry to the war has changed dramatically where the overall strategic position lies. And, you know, part of that thinking revolves around what we constantly refer to when we talk about the events of 1918, which is, when will the American Expeditionary Force arrive? When will it actually cross the Atlantic, and when will it contribute to the fighting on the Western Front? And nobody is expecting that to happen before 1919. The AEF has got to be formed. People have got to be enlisted. The draft is produced immediately after the US entry, but an army can't be, a mass army cannot be magicked out of the ground in the way in which the armies of 1914 are, because in 1914, European powers have enormous reserves on which to draw who can be readily mobilized. But what I think that misses, and this is why the German situation is even more desperate, is what has been achieved at sea in 1917 and 1918. If we're thinking of this in the context of the experience of the Second World War and the importance of the Battle of the Atlantic to underpinning D-Day and the Allied invasion of Western Europe, then think of the context of 1917-18, when the German U-boat campaign is at its height, and the Battle of the Atlantic of the First World War seems unwon. The US entry in April 1917 transforms that balance, and the naval impact of America's entry to the war is actually, although less visible, in some ways just as important as the military impact. Because, first of all, the US Navy contributes immediately to the war effort. Admiral Sims arrives in European waters with his ships within a month. They're integrated. There's no debate about command as there is with the American Army in France. They're integrated immediately within an Allied structure. And that matters enormously because what the US can bring is the escorts that are needed for convoys. And those convoys, this is the second enormous advantage, those convoys can form up now within American territorial waters. They don't have to form up in the Atlantic, in waters that are immediately open to attack from German submarines. And alongside that, a third consideration, is that the ships that are available for the transport of goods initially, but ultimately, of course, of American soldiers to Europe, are enhanced by America's entry. German vessels that have been interned in the United States when the United States is still neutral are now available for use. The US has a massive shipbuilding program of its own. And the fourth point, of course, that follows from this is that Allied purchasing in the US of munitions and of other supplies is now funded in a way that it hadn't been actually between 1916 and 1917. The Allies have been buying on a wing and a prayer because the Federal Reserve Board had decided that the United States had overinvested in the possibility of an Allied victory. So, you know, the fact that the clock is ticking on Germany is not just this issue of when will the AEF arrive in Europe. It's also that actually the global resource battle, if you like, has been transformed in much shorter order and will have an effect in 1918 itself. And the benefit of that is not just that goods can come through and in due course soldiers could come through earlier than had been anticipated as the Germans launched their offensives. The benefit of that also is that the alliance that Germany is facing is cohering in a way that it had not been before. The United States is not a full ally, it declares itself an associate, is anxious not to get too deeply embedded in the skullduggery, as they would see it, that's been going on between the Allied powers, these secret agreements which the Bolsheviks have exposed that shows that, you know, they're all empires underneath, despite this talk about democracy and international order and all that. So the associate status matters, but the very fact that the United States is so important to all of them means, of course, that they will actually come together in order to woo the United States, in order to make sure that America's contribution is as effective as it can be. And that works out, not just at sea, by Sims coming in under effectively British command, and by America's support, at least in the short term, for British leadership in the war at sea. It also comes into play in the war on land, because as will come clear with the appointment of Foch as the Allied Generalissimo during the course of the first German offensive, the Allies are actually coming together in terms of their coordination of land operations and of the forces that they have available on land in the course of the winter of 1917-18, because they know that when the EAF comes, they will have to think how to integrate it.
Right.
And in order to do that, they've got to be joined up themselves.
Right, and you alluded to another key strategic development in which the Germans capitalize on, and it's a somewhat fortuitous one, in that the Russians are essentially out of the war. Two revolutions in 1917, there's a lukewarm provisional government response to the First World War, but they keep Russia in, the Bolsheviks have no such compunction, and Russia's out. That two-front war is gone. So the strategic dimension on land has changed dramatically.
Absolutely, and that has two direct consequences, which paradoxically turn out to be in the Allies' favor. The first is that for the first time in this war, the Western Front is actually the most important front in the war. And you know, this is a somewhat tired debate in Britain, and it's sort of self-evident for the United States that the Western Front must be the most important front of the war. But you know, if you judge this war from Berlin's perspective, there is Berlin in the center of Europe, and the Eastern Front, and of course there is more than one Eastern Front. There's the front with Russia, there's the front with the Ottoman Empire, there's a Balkan Front. The Eastern Front is as demanding of resources and of troops, or nearly as demanding, as the Western Front. The Western Front matters to Britain and to the United States because it is where you will put your troops in. I mean, you know, you're going to send a large army, you're going to create a mass army, you can't send it to Europe except to Western Europe. Mm-hmm. I mean, even today, the United States has to think, if they're going to move divisions fast from the United States to continental Europe, how do you get them there? And sea is still the best mm-hmm. way to do it. So the nearest landfall is where your army is going to be. Now, this really is the important front, the Western Front, because it is the main front for Germany too, in a way that it hasn't been before. So as the American contribution is going to be the important one in 1919, if you're thinking forwards from the perspective of early 1918, the fact that the Western Front is going to be the most important front, those two things converge. The downside, the big downside of the Russian defeat, because that effectively is what it will become with the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk in 1918, for the Germans, and it's surprising that it's a downturn, is that their alliance, the alliance of the Central Powers, the alliance of Germany, Austria-Hungary, Bulgaria and the Ottoman Empire, will fall apart because Germany's allies have absolutely no interest in the Western Front. Right. You know, there are two Austrian divisions deployed to the Western Front in 1918 as a sort of token gesture, but none of the other allies are concerned with it. I mean, the Ottomans' concerns are self-evidently in the Middle East mm-hmm. and in the Caucasus. And the Bulgarians' interests are in Bulgaria. And the defeat of Russia, or the exit of the war from Russia, and the peace treaty, the punitive peace treaty is then imposed, actually means that they've won their war. Why should they carry on fighting? And certainly, why should they carry on fighting in France? That there is absolutely no interest. So as the Allies, in terms of the United States, the United Kingdom, France, and Britain and the others, are coming together, the Central Powers are falling apart.
So we have, and you've sketched this out very well, we have a solidifying, if you like, of the strategic situation. From the German perspective, is it now or never? What makes this the most propitious moment really for this offensive?
It is now or never. It is now or never because they can concentrate their army on the Western Front. They bring over 30 divisions from the east to the west. The question is, how are they to be used and where are they to be used? And that is a debate that is ongoing. There are a number of German officers who say, and of course this has been true throughout the war, but it's become even more acute. In terms of resources, we are overmatched by our opponents. We must therefore, in military terms, concentrate on the decisive point with our superior forces. But where on the Western Front? Where will you have strategic effect? The decisions within the German High Command, within the OHL, are essentially ones of compromise. Because they're not led by what we would know as a strategic argument, they're led by a tactical argument. Where will you achieve breakthrough? This is, you know, one of the reflections of the challenges of trench warfare, because you may have a grand strategic design, but if you have a very strong tactical defensive position, are you going to be able to achieve a grand strategic design? If you think back to the fighting of 1916 or even of 1917, armies think about how do they achieve tactical breakthroughs against trench systems But then they have the problem of where they're going, even if they achieve that breakthrough. Right. And the problem for Germany is exactly that. And they attack both in March 1918 and in April 1918 on two very obvious weak points. But actually, they're weak partly because the ground behind them doesn't seem to matter so much, especially in March 1918. Where are they going? When the Allies have been attacking on the Somme, which is the sector they decide to attack on, when the Allies have been attacking on the Somme in 1916, Fayol, who was the French army commander and actually achieved the initial successes in July 1916 on the Somme, said, where are we going? You know, once we get through here, what is there? If you visit the Somme countryside, you'll get the point. There isn't an obvious, immediately available strategic objective. One emerges in the course of March 1918, which is the railway junction at Amiens, the main railway link between Paris and northern France, and particularly, of course, towards the Channel ports, passes through Amiens, and that becomes a focus, particularly for the Allied defense. But it's striking that it's not actually there in terms of the decision-making. Ludendorff says, you know, we'll get a breakthrough, and Ludendorff being the first quartermaster general of the German High Command, we'll get a breakthrough, and then we'll think about where we're going after that.
Which is a fascinating consideration when you think the last, we'll call it a roll of the dice, strategic gamble of the Germans on the Western Front really has a very loose sense of what that strategic object actually is.
There is, in operational terms, it's not at all clear where they're going. And it's reinforced by the fact, you referred to four offensives in all in the first half of 1918, and by some calculations there are five. Mm-hmm. But each one is essentially independently mounted with very little idea of how they should be coordinated or what their reciprocal effects should be. And one of the reasons why, one of the consequences for that, and this of course is an advantage for Germany, is that the intelligence is therefore contradictory. Mm-hmm. The Allies themselves can't decide where the next offensive is going to come, partly because the Germans can't decide where the next offensive right. is going to come. And so it's not that the intelligence collection is necessarily bad, it's reflecting the real situation. Right. So Douglas Haig, the British commander-in-chief, having been on the receiving end of two offensives in March and in April 1918, thinks the next are bound to come against him too. And Foch, who by then is the Allied generalissimo and has to think about the relationship between the British and the French armies and where the Americans should be deployed when they come in, is saying, no, we can't be sure of that. We think it might actually come, as indeed it does come, against the French. Which is what happens at the end of May. And then what happens too is that the Allies are busy imputing strategic objectives to each of these attacks when there aren't. So the March 1918 offensive is concluded as having been mounted in order to split the British and the French armies. It is a weak point in the line, and it does hit the army, the British army, the British Fifth Army, closest mm-hmm. to the French, and that army is extended over a much longer front in less good positions than elsewhere on the Western Front. But that actually is added on as an explanation for what is happening. You know, and the intention is to break through, and here, of course, there is a parallel with the ideas behind the Battle of the Bulge in 1944, the breakthrough and then drive for the Channel ports. But again, this all comes as events unfold
right.
rather than as part of a grand design.
Right. We could probably give the German High Command perhaps a BC grade for good strategic thinking. Tactically, however, the Germans are far more adept in these battles. Perhaps you can speak a little bit about tactical innovations and how they managed to break that deadlock on the Western Front.
Yeah, people see the tactics that are used in March 1918 as a forerunner of what will happen in the early days of the Second World War. Combined arms tactics in many respects, the ability to reinforce success rather than try to redeem failure, and of course the attack being led by stormtroopers who are exploiting these weak points where they can find them in the line and then penetrating as far and fast as they can. These are actually not as new as they're necessarily cracked up to be. Stormtroopers have been evolving in the German army since 1915. At the Battle of Verdun, in the opening, on the opening day, they used stormtroopers to have a similar effect to work out where the weak points are in French defences in 1916, and then to renew the artillery attack against those. But what this means is that in March 1918, when the offensive is launched on the 21st of March 1918, the Germans are using artillery to stun the enemy rather than try to destroy positions. They're aiming to overrun rather than to create deep destruction. And that's aided partly by weather conditions. It's a misty day, 21st of March 1918. It's aided by the fact the line is very thinly held at the point of attack. And actually, British units surrender in very large numbers very quickly, very often because they find Germans to their rear, something they're totally unused to experiencing, and think, you know, we are surrounded, effectively, we're going to fall. So the attack gains momentum, which the Germans absolutely sustain tactically. But what they're doing, and this is a downside, is they're losing fire. They're gaining movement, but what they're not doing is coordinating fire and movement as well as they might. Because the further they advance, the further they're moving away from their own artillery support. They've got their own integrated firepower. They try to bring mortars with them. They're moving in sections of 7 to 10 men with grenades and automatic weapons and so on in an endeavor to carry their own firepower. But ultimately, you're going to need artillery support. And what Germany does not have the capacity to do as the deeper into the positions they get is to bring artillery up fast enough to be able to support that. So fire and movement, as the battle develops, are becoming separated rather than coordinated. So there's an immense initial advantage and then a dissipating effect the further in, and they get a long way in, further into the Allied positions they get.
You mentioned Hugh quite rightly that these sort of the antecedents of these tactics go back a couple of years. What is it that brings them together in the decisive tactical fashion right now and in these conflicts that have been absent beforehand?
Well, I think that it's partly that they have been tried and tested in breakthrough battles on other fronts. Mm-hmm. So there has been an opportunity to maneuver in Russia in 1917 as the Russian army is broken up after the first Russian Revolution. So there's been experimentation going on there. And most importantly, the breakthrough battle at Caporetto on the Italian front in October 1917, where, again, the principle of reinforcing success rather than redeeming failure, and the ability to use artillery not in prolonged bombardments. I mean, the big debate of the First World War is, because artillery has become the dominant weapon really by 1918, is do you use artillery as a destructive force, and therefore do you prolong your bombardments in order to maximize your destruction of defensive positions, or do you keep it short and sudden so you maintain surprise, if you can, because of course even the concentration of guns can reveal your intentions. And what actually happens in the context of 1918 and what has been developed in 1917, and it works well with Germany as it's running out of shells and running out of resources, is you keep your artillery bombardment short and sudden, and then maximize the surprise effect by following through. So in some ways, it's the change in the artillery battle that is perhaps the most important part of this, because that is what facilitates the opportunity for the infantry to advance thereafter.
So the Allies are faced with a pretty coherent tactical assault. What is their first response? How are they dealing with that initially?
Very badly. And partly it is that this attack on the 21st of March 1918 has come into a front which the British have only just taken over. They extended their line. Partly that the British Army has peaked in terms of its strength in 1917. It's now a weaker army The Manpower Committee of the Cabinet in 1918 puts the army third in its order of priorities for receiving men, concentrating on war production for the first two priorities. And the front that it's taken over, of course, is also a front that has been fought over consistently since 1914, and particularly in 1916, because it's the Somme battlefield. So it doesn't have depth. So there are plans for deeper positions, but those positions are mostly marked out on the ground rather than constructed, because the manpower isn't there to deliver it. And then what happens is panic going back up the command chain. So the reports are coming in. The British Fifth Army knows an attack is possible. They have a pretty good idea of when it might come. But there is still this debate about whether this will be the principal attack or whether it will not be the principal attack. And as the reports go back up the command chain, and particularly as they reach Corps headquarters distance from the battle, actually loses control of the battle. And so the question is, should they be reinforcing the front to make sure that it holds, or should they be pulling back in good time to make sure they don't lose more troops? So there is a failure there. One part that does work well, and Douglas Haig is very bad at giving any credit for this, and it goes back to this point about Allied coordination, is the French come to the rescue. The French from the south put over 20 divisions into the battle immediately. What Douglas Haig and Philippe Pétain, the French commander-in-chief, have done between the two of them is coordinate a program of mutual support in the event of a German attack. And they've done that in part because they don't want to lose sovereign command to an Allied generalissimo. To the appointment of an Allied generalissimo, they don't want to give troops to an Allied reserve, a coordinated Allied reserve. So in the winter of 1917-18, they do a deal which says effectively the British will come to the French rescue if the French get attacked, and the French will come to the British rescue if the British get attacked. And that works. It works well in both battles, in all these battles, and it works even better after the 26th of March 1918, because at that point an Allied generalissimo is appointed in the shape of Foch to coordinate this work. So Allied coordination is good. By comparison, German High Command is not good. We think of the German High Command as brilliant. You know, Auftragstaktik, delegation forward. They put the mission at the tactical level and let the junior commander dictate the battle. Well, at a tactical level, that works okay, but the operational level, not at all, because actually there are three armies involved in this battle on the 21st March 1918, and two army groups over them. So at the operational level, every decision has to get referred back up the command chain to Hindenburg and Ludendorff, to the German Supreme Command. So they're still trying to control things from top down when it comes to coordinating what is happening tactically with what might happen operationally and strategically. So it's not Auftragstaktik in practice. It's maybe tactically Auftragstaktik, but it's not in terms of its wider repercussions.
Well, and you touch on a good point, which is that historians and the military venerate German Auftragstaktik ideas and the ability to think on their feet on the ground, tactical brilliance, sacrifice somewhat for strategic wooliness in this situation. What more could the Germans have done? Could they have made that decisive breakthrough, that decisive moment? Was victory a possibility, however victory is defined?
Well, you know, what are the strategic objectives behind the Allied front line? You know, if you work down the front from the Channel coast, the Channel ports would be the first one. Cut the British expeditionary force off from its bases. Certainly the railway junction at Amiens is another. And as becomes evident with the third German offensive, that in Champagne on the 27th of May, 1918, Paris could become an objective too. But these are a heck of a long way away from, you know, your breakthroughs going to have to get very far. And it's striking, of course, it gets far enough to trigger worries about those. But that's where you would have to go to have any decisive effect. And beyond that, the point remains that the Allies know if they can hang on, the Americans will come eventually. So actually, this is a coalition conflict still. And even overrunning France, even getting the British driven back to the Channel ports and the French army driven back to Paris, still doesn't mean the war is lost. What the Germans have to do is to have a negotiating position. And by the summer of 1918, many Germans, particularly in the Foreign Office, the foreign ministers, successive foreign ministers, have realized that that is what they're going to have to do. But that still hasn't percolated through to the German high command. And the problem here is German government. And again, there is, if you like, a Second World War parallel. But the German government in 1917-18 could, as it's been described for much of the years of the Nazis, be described as polycratic chaos. I mean, there are too many groups here with interests and insufficient coordination going on. And it's far worse in the First World War in some ways in 1917-18 than it is in the German case in the Second World War, where at least Hitler is a dictator. But in the context of 1917-18, the army has a disproportionate political influence. The chancellor is successive chancellors, relatively weak. But of course, it has no formal role except the right of direct access to the Kaiser. It also, within OHL, within the Supreme Command, doesn't have the capacity to coordinate the war as a whole. So when the Allies begin counterattacking in August 1918, there is a conference at Spa on the 13th of August 1918, where the Austrians turn up and there are representatives from Germany's allies, and they have a review of where they are on all fronts. And they begin on all the eastern fronts, and they come round to the western front, and then they review the situation on the western front. And of course, by the time they've got there, they think, gosh, we're still winning this war. And it's an entirely military judgment. And the conclusion that the meeting comes to, despite pressure from Germany's allies, is to say, well, we'll need to negotiate at some time, but not now. It's always not now.
Right.
And actually, if you're going to launch these offensives in the first half of 1918, you needed to tie them to some political objective.
Right.
But there isn't a political objective there.
I think in there, Hugh, you made a small positive case for dictatorship in terms of command and control. Just a small one.
So democracy is still within this war.
That's right. So jumping ahead and looking back 75 years to the Battle of the Bulge, there are superficial commonalities, if you like, between last gasp offensive on the Western Front for Imperial Germany in 1918, last gasp strategic offensive for Nazi Germany in the winter of 44-45. Can you speak to those superficial commonalities?
It is surprising that given the experience of 1918, that in 1944, the Allies aren't better prepared for what happens. Because although we can think of the offensives of the first half of 1918 as, you know, an effort to win the war, once the last of those offensives has gone in July 1918, then the war is lost, and those at the Western Front, rather than those more widely distributed among the Allies, recognize that might begin to be the case. There is still within Allied councils fear of yet another German offensive, right up until the 11th of November 1918. At every point, even while the armistice negotiations are going on, there is concern that Germany will have one more round in the in the chamber. And if it's not going to be on the Western Front, it'll be on the Italian front. They'll attack the Italians. And what the impression they have been left with after these offensives is the German army has immense capacities. In fact, they make them 10 feet tall when they're not. And the only reason I can find for doing this, and this relates to 1944, is how do you assess German strength? And in 1918, they assess German strength in divisional numbers without realizing those divisions are depleted, not just by battlefield casualties, but by influenza. Roughly 400,000, 500,000 German soldiers were in hospital in September 1918. So there is an expectation of another German offensive, which in 1944 there isn't. I mean, what is striking after D-Day is the Allies think, well, we're on the roll now. Mm-hmm. You know, Germans are being attacked from west and from east. The war will be over by the end of 1944. And the reason for that is that their gaze has shifted to what happens in 1918. The collapse comes much, much quicker in the First World War than anybody had anticipated. Remember, it's not meant to happen until 1919 or 1920. Right. And the Germans have postponed the idea of negotiation. So, you know, 1944, there is a sense, well, it'll happen very quickly because there'll be collapse at home. The stab in the back legend, the argument that Germany is defeated because there's revolution at home in 1918, that absolutely takes a grip in Allied councils. You know, Hitler will be toppled. The July bomb plot is an indication of that.
Interesting.
And if Hitler's toppled, then Germany will implode from within, as the argument is it did in 1918, which of course is reading the German Revolution of November 1918 backwards into the earlier part of 1918. The revolution actually follows the request for an armistice, not precedes it.
Right.
But that's, if you like, the lesson, the wrong lesson learnt by the Allies in 1944, which I think is what generates some of this surprise and shock when the German offensive, the Ardennes offensive, comes in at the end of
44. You spoke eloquently about the lack of a firm strategic objective in 1918. Is that the case in 1944?
Yes, it is. Except that, if Hitler has one preoccupation, it seems to me, it is the sense that the Allies should be more brittle than they are. You know, why? Mm-hmm. Why are the Americans and Russians in the same alliance? Why is this Grand Alliance holding so well together, when the logical situation is a joint front against the Bolsheviks? That is what many German army officers, of course, are thinking about in 44 and into 45, which is, you know, after this war is over, we've got the bigger threat, as indeed it had been a concern in 1918. For many British generals in particular, and British politicians, including Winston Churchill, in 1918, it's the Bolshevik, not the Bosch, that matters, because we know we can beat the Bosch eventually, but actually we've got a longer term threat here if we're thinking strategically, and that is communism. So if there is a strategic objective, that is it. But actually what is more striking is the view that comes specifically out of Nazi belief and out of fascism, which is not there in 1918, which is, you know, if Germany is going to go down, if Nazi Germany is going to go down, if the thousand-year Reich is going to collapse, then it's got to go down fighting. It's got to go down in flames. And that, of course, is not a strategic objective in the sense in which we would identify it.
No, absolutely. Are the Germans looking, in 1944, is Hitler and the German High Command, are they looking back to 18 for inspiration and trying to right the wrongs or the missed opportunities of 18?
Absolutely, because for them, the stab in the back and legend is crucial. That's one of the reasons why it doesn't happen.
Right.
I mean, and particularly after the July bomb plot, you know, when Guderian comes in as chief of the general staff and immediately gets everybody to renew essentially their loyalty to the Reich, the army is as committed to the party as it's ever been in 44, 45. And so that is because for the army, the fear of collapse at home and the fear of a division between what the army is doing in the field and what is happening domestically is a direct inheritance from their understanding of what happened in 1918.
Had the Germans employed those forces they deployed in the West on the Eastern Front, could they have held the Russians for very much longer than they ultimately did? Would that have changed the position, potentially speaking to that, and if you read some accounts, deeply held belief that at some juncture this Grand Alliance will collapse, the Anglo-Americans will join with the Germans and fight the Bolsheviks. Is there any traction with any of that in your mind?
Well, I can see the political traction that might operate in a German mind if you made that case. But the real challenge here is, you know, where is your best operational chance of success? And it comes back to the tactical operational arguments about where can you deliver victory? And the answer is you can much more easily deliver victory in the West than you can in the East. You're operating over shorter ranges. There are at least some realizable strategic objectives that could have some effect if you achieve from a tactical base, from a breakthrough base, if you like, a momentum. And so that idea of the thrust from the Ardennes is at least consonant with the time and space limitations that you're operating under. I mean, I think, you know, the big challenge, it seems to me, for the German army in the Second World War is it comes to believe its own myth. If Blitzkrieg is a myth, if in the end the 1940 attack surprises everybody, including the German army, in terms of its success, and is essentially improvised day by day as a result of a series of tactical and operational successes, and amounts to a delivery of a strategic success with the fall of France in 1940, then the challenge for Germany is to realize that that's a one-off, that it's not a repeatable formula. And yet, of course, by 1941, it's begun to believe that confronted with very different geographical considerations, confronted with a campaign that has to be conducted to a much greater depth than was the case in France or in Western Europe, you can deliver a similar sort of result. And clearly you can't. I mean, the things just don't stack up. I mean, they come closer, you could obviously argue, in 1941, 42 than you might have imagined. But given the fact that the German army actually hasn't delivered a significant tactical and operational success since 1943, the expectation you can do so at the tail end of the war and turn that into a strategic and political success is fantasy land, isn't it?
It is, I think, but it's a fascinating sort of insight into perhaps the German military mind, in that tactical and operational brilliance in 1918 fails to deliver a decisive strategic victory. Tactical and operational brilliance in 1940 somewhat coincidentally deliver the strategic victory. So why not roll the dice again in the winter of 44-45?
Absolutely. And what it comes down to is how do you see the strategy and define it? And how do you see strategy as essentially a military business which is debated between high commands and subordinate units, and you deliver a success, and then you work out how you actually exploit that and develop it in political terms? Or do you see this as, particularly given the scale of war you're conducting a coalition conflict over multiple theatres, do you see this as involving an inherently political element all the way through? And as in 1918, so in 1944-45, the advantage for the Allies is that they're capable of doing that. They can see that there is a relationship here which has to be thought through. And so, you know, what happens at the end of the First World War is that you get a military success by the end of the war, a military success that surprises everybody because it comes so much earlier than anybody had anticipated, but particularly surprises the politicians, who are totally unprepared for a peace conference, which then has to be brokered in double quick time, with the result that it's botched, while fighting is still actually going on in 1919 and even through to 1921, 22, 23. Whereas in the case of 1945, the Allies have actually been thinking through
how they might do this. You know, they, if they achieve the unconditional surrender of Germany, they've still got a war with Japan to fight. But if they achieve an unconditional surrender with Germany, they at least know what they're trying to do. They have thought it through. They've given them some consideration. And they know there'll be challenges with the Soviet Union, just as the Soviet Union knows they're in competition with the United States, the United Kingdom, France, and so on. But they're aware of that. They have factored that into their calculations. What is staggering at the end of 1918 is that actually the Allies are not ready. Different theatre entirely, but Allenby, having won his victory at Megiddo at the end of September 1918, signals the British Foreign Office, signals Arthur Balfour, and says, what do I do if the Germans ask for an armistice? What are my political conditions? To which, to paraphrase, Balfour replies, I haven't the foggiest idea. You know, not a good situation to be in.
No, absolutely not. So at least we can say in World War II, the Allies have somewhat learned from history to be prepared. And learning from history is, of course, what we're all about here. Hugh Strawn, that's the end of our formal discussion. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Wonderful exposition of what went on. And ladies and gentlemen, we're going to go to question and answer. So if you have a question for Sir Hugh, please raise your hand. We have microphones in the balcony and downstairs.
Is it fair to criticize the Germans for not bringing more troops from the east to the west more quickly? It seems like the Brest-Litovsk negotiations dragged on for weeks on end. And weren't there German troops involved in overseeing like Ukrainian wheat harvests and whatnot?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are something like 1 million German troops and of course, large numbers of Austrians too, still on the Eastern Front. Many of them are older soldiers, not necessarily best fitted for active combat on the Western Front. That's part of the problem. But the other part of the problem is, you know, if you're going to sustain this war any longer, what Brest-Litovsk does is actually potentially give you the resource to continue the war for longer. You know, Ukraine and its grain, for example, that could feed you through the winter of 1918-1919. So you do actually need this. I mean, the fact that the Germans and the Austrians start squabbling over who should have what doesn't help the alliance. But there is still an issue there of how long are you going to be able to maintain this war. There's another issue I think you need to think about too, and that is, think of the scale of the German Empire by the summer of 1918. You know, it bears some sort of comparison to Nazi rule in the beginning of 41. You know, it's running from sort of midpoint in France right over to cover what has been all of European Russia. But they haven't got a railway infrastructure to sustain that. They haven't been maintaining their railway lines. They're running out of coal. The locomotives are knackered. The railway line hasn't been properly maintained. And they can't easily move large numbers of troops. And they confront this at the end of the autumn of 1918, when the Bulgarians seek an armistice. And they say to AHL, we need 7 divisions on the Macedonian front in order to be able to hold. And Ludendorff replies, you can't have them, partly because, of course, he wants every man in the West, but also, actually, he couldn't have got them there if he had tried to move them. So there is an issue here there are other considerations to play. But yes, absolutely, there are still a large number of soldiers committed in the East, German soldiers in 1918.
Thank you, Sir Hugh, for your lucid presentation. You mentioned in passing that by the fall of 1918, one of the factors that was leading to Germany's quick collapse was 500,000 people that were invalided and sick. What was the effect of the influenza pandemic upon the Germans' ability to mount the march through June 1918 offensives and upon the Allies' ability to resist it?
What's extraordinary about that question is we still haven't got a good answer to it. And it seems to me extraordinary. We have a discussion about the German army in 1918, which again and again talks about the numbers of soldiers the Germans lose in those offensives in terms of casualties, of the order of 800, 900,000 are killed, wounded, or missing, i.e. they're being captured in most cases, but they may be missing as well. But we don't aggregate those with the numbers who are sick. And I suspect in the first half of 1918, and there may be much better medical historians here than I am, but actually the influenza epidemic does not seem to hit hard in the first half of 1918, but it absolutely is hitting hard by September 1918. So that figure I gave you, that high figure, which is in the German official history, which is for September 1918, is a staggering figure, actually. And I remember when I was a young academic in Cambridge, that one of the fellows of my college had been a medical officer with the British Field Artillery unit on the Western Front in September 1918. And he said we had drivers falling off the horses as we were advancing with influenza. It was striking so dramatically. In October 1918, on the Bulgarian front, on the Macedonian front, where the French are aiming to lead a breakthrough, and Franche d'Esprit is talking about getting to Vienna and being the French first Frenchman since Napoleon in 1809 to ride victorious into Vienna, he's got two divisions out of action with influenza. On that front, it's been malaria that's been the big cause of sickness up till that point, but now it's flu. So there is a military consequence, undoubtedly. And is this sufficient to, you know, to explain the way the war ends so quickly? No, because actually monocausal explanations won't do, but it's certainly an important factor.
Did the West make the same mistake at the end of the Cold War in 1991 that it did in 1918 by not planning for the end of the Cold War, just like the same mistake was made at the end of 1918?
Right.
No small question.
Absolutely. It is surprising, isn't it, how absolutely fixed the Cold War becomes in people's imaginations. And I suppose, you know, if I'm doing a comparison with the First World War, that is, there is a similarity there in that people have learnt to live with this war to the point they can't actually see it ever ending. So many soldiers in the First World War say, you know, one way to live with this war is to recognise that it's become a fact of life, that it's not going to go away. And in the 1980s, that is absolutely true. I remember to my cost a discussion in the British Ministry of Defence in 1983 after President Reagan had given his Star Wars speech. And I raised the possibility that if there were an effective system of anti-ballistic missile defence, then this could actually change the equation in terms of nuclear deterrence. And we might actually have to think that, you know, the Cold War won't last forever and ever and that there will be a change in the relationship. So it wasn't prompted by the notion of, you know, collapse from within, but a change in the military situation. And it was dismissed absolutely out of hand as sheer fantasy that there will be any change in the strategic relationship in the foreseeable future. So I think, you know, there is a genuine sense of surprise. And as you, I'm sure, know that in the 1990s, what is happening militarily and strategically is a very slow adjustment to the idea that Russia, as the successor state to the Soviet Union, is not going to be a threat. You know, which is one of the reasons why, of course, today Putin can say, or others can say, we didn't take the opportunity sufficiently quickly in the early 1990s. To convert Russia and to recognize where Russia was in terms of its openness to a better relationship with the West. So yes, I'd be tempted to go down that line. We missed our moment by failing to see what the opportunities were. But we didn't maintain the possibility of a revived Russian threat, Of course, there were others like Mrs. Thatcher who were more concerned about the re-emergence of a united Germany and the threat that that might pose. So there were other considerations running too.
We have time for one more question.
And your response about the Cold War and the balance of power leads into this. Is there an analysis to be made of what we call World War I as not exactly a war, but given the fact that the trench system was established and then maintained as an occupation that lasted 4 years, surrounded by perhaps even an intractable balance of power because the Germans moved first, established it, and so did the politicians and those involved perceive these as futile strategic and tactical maneuvers and perhaps a perpetual balance of power on the French-German border?
There is, from the very beginning of the First World War, there are efforts to broker a peace, you know, from the winter of 1914-15. And Woodrow Wilson knew that to his cost. I mean, Edward House had gone to Europe precisely to explore the opportunities for peace. The challenge here, and what, you know, militates against any way out of this, is that, first of all, if you don't negotiate a peace that involves everybody, if you simply have a separate peace where allies break off one from another, and the hope in Germany is that Russia will break off and do a deal with Germany, that actually that will be a better way to win the war. In other words, peacemaking becomes part of war making and is not separate from it. And that is why, from the Allied point of view, right up until Woodrow Wilson's peace initiative of the end of 1916, there is a reluctance to engage seriously in peace talks because the fear is it will be a way of dividing and conquering. And the other side of this argument is that peacemaking itself is very hard to do if you're doing it from a position of inferiority. And for the Allies, with northern France under German occupation, to pick up your point about occupation, the whole of Belgium, to all intents and purposes, under occupation, from 1915, Serbia under occupation, and from 1916, most of Romania under occupation, all these are Allies, you don't have a very strong negotiating position. Why the hell should Germany, if possession is 9/10 of the law, agree to a deal that actually goes back, as the Bolsheviks proposed at the end of 1917, to the status quo ante? There is no basis for doing so until you've achieved sufficient militarily to underpin your negotiating position. So, yes, in many respects, this is an occupation, and these fronts are enormously, are very largely static. But when there is movement, as there is in 1914 or as there is against in 1918, then you have the opportunity to negotiate. But of course, in 1914, it's early days. In 1918, the Allies sense, of course, there is an opportunity for even greater victory. And they need the Germans to initiate the peace talks.
Excellent stuff. Sir Hugh Strawn, great start to the symposium.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you very much. Thank you to Sir Hugh Strawn for a fascinating discussion. And thank you to Citadel Securities for sponsoring the 2019 On War Symposium. To learn more about the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, visit us in person or online at pritzkermilitary.org. Thank you, and please join us next time on Pritzker Military Presents.
Visit the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago. Explore original exhibits on military history or be a part of a live studio audience. Watch other episodes of Pritzker Military Presents. Find out what's on at pritzkermilitary.org. Pritzker Military Presents is made possible by members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library and its sponsors. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the museum and library. The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.